I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards?
Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Tom Lucy Plus One. We're going to get straight into it this week. Our guest is Danny Wallace. Danny is a hugely successful author and screenwriter, and he very kindly agreed to sit down with me and have a chat. We actually recorded this on his hotel room balcony in London. Just a couple of days ago, so please excuse some of the background noise. And also, my microphone didn't pick up the very beginning of the conversation, so it kind of starts in the middle of a chat that we were having about Danny working with Jim Carrey. So just to explain that. But anyway, I'll see you at the end. This is the brilliant Danny Wallace. So Jim Carrey, that all happened through other people.
Yeah, so, and then, you know, he, I think, heard about it, they sent it to him and wanted to do it. And then that was that. But one of the best things about that was watching him on set. You know, when you're sort of a kid, you watch these Jim Carrey movies and you watch the film and then you see the bit at the end where he's mucking about and it's making the crew laugh.
Yeah.
Something hit me one day. I'm going to see that. I'm going to see him do that. And I did. And it was some of the greatest thing. You know, he was just... He had no fear. At one point, he just really did something no one was expecting and just flung himself around and did a massive Jim Carrey pratfall. And I was like, that's amazing. You know, if that doesn't make the film, it'll at least be in the sort of the end credits, you know.
Yeah.
And but then you forget that he's getting on now. And next time I saw him, he walked around the corner and he just had like two or three ice packs on his ribs because he'd like cracked one. And he just said, look, every film I do, I like to do something that even I don't know I'm about to do. And you know, for him, it was that
sort of method acting, Jim Carrey. Because I watched that documentary.
Oh, like, Jim and Andy.
Yeah.
The Netflix thing, the Andy Kaufman thing.
Great, but it was like insane.
It was insane, wasn't it? And I saw a little bit of that in him, but I also saw quite a kind of a calm him. there was one nice moment where there was a writer's strike on at the time, so the only things happening on that lot was the film Yes Man and like an episode of ER. So you either saw people who were in Yes Man or you saw people in like fake casts and stuff like that. And I felt sorry for all these tourists who'd obviously booked their holiday there from like Tallahassee or something 6 months in advance, had got their Warner Brothers studio tour pass, and nothing's happening. So it's just a man going, there's another brown building, just like all the other brown buildings I've just shown you. And I was talking to Jim about that, and I still find it uncomfortable saying Jim. You know what I mean? It's like Jim Carrey. Because I hate that on chat shows when you see people going, yeah, Bob De Niro. It's Robert De Niro.
Bobby De Niro.
Jeez. Anyway, so I'm there next to Jim Carrey.
J-Bone.
And I mentioned that, and he goes, yeah, yeah. And then he just thinks something, and he goes, I'll be back in a minute. And he just ran out to one of those little tourists, open-air tourist buses, and just leapt on it and just started shaking it wildly like King Kong and screaming. And at first, obviously, everyone's thinking, we're all going to die. There's a madman. And suddenly they start to recognise, oh, my God, that's him. And they start taking pictures, and he's grabbing people's phones and calling people. And he did it for, like, 5 minutes, but it felt like a long time.
Yeah.
And then he ran away and came back to me. And it was like, that was such a nice thing to do. Because those people, now their holiday's been saved. They've got anecdotes for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
And he just did a good thing that he did not need to do.
That's really cool.
So I thought that was great.
I think, was it in that Jim and Andy thing where he talked about maybe the same thing with the tours around the studios and he chased one of them with an axe?
Yeah.
The truck was going off and he ran after it with like a pickaxe.
Yeah.
Not as Jim Carrey, like in costume as someone.
Yeah.
Just to scare the people on the door.
It's just amazing. Yeah, exactly. He is, I just saw him at one point, we were filming something for like the DVD extras and he made the director sit down in the chair and then he was going to pretend to cut the guy's hair. Peyton Reed's hair. But I think he just turned the clippers on and just started doing it anyway.
Yeah.
Which is really not what Peyton wanted at that time. But you've got to let him do what he's going to do.
I remember watching like his stand-up before I started stand-up.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought it was like the funniest thing. He was such a good stand-up.
He was. And again, you see in that sort of Jim and Andy documentary, don't you? Like just him really thinking, what do they want?
Yeah.
What do they want me to be? What do they want me to say? Like putting so much effort. There's so much. These days it's like, well, here's my point of view and here's what I'm saying. But he was much more about, what do you want from me?
Yeah.
What can I give you?
Yeah.
That sort of weird sort of neediness in a good way. I see, weirdly, my son reminds me so much of Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey.
And he was only born, well, I've got to talk to my wife about this, because he was only born about 9 or 10 months after we've been out there. So I've got to talk about to my wife about what happened there.
Yeah, that could be a problem.
Yeah.
He's a bit well known for that, Jim Carrey, isn't he?
Is he? Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
So that year was 2009, 2008.
That came out, 2000, Christmas 2009, I think.
And then after that, did you get swamped with Hollywood offers?
Well, it left a lot of doors open, wide open. You know, and still, once you've had something made out there, or even if you've sold a script, it's a lot easier to get meetings because people, they see a track record and they think, oh, someone else has paid him for this, so let's do that. I mean, you know, I've talked about this before, but one of the first meetings I had after Yes Man was I went to my agent on the way back to the airport, and he said, so when's the next book? And it was a while away, so I said, it's a while away. And he was like, sounds like it's a while away. I was like, yep. And he said, have you written, you know, like an article? Because we can sell articles, you know, they can lead to things. And I wrote this column for a magazine, and I guess then I'd been doing it for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And I was starting to think, maybe I'll put them together in a book. And I'd never said the title of the book out loud to anyone, but I thought, I'm going to call it Awkward Situations for Men. And I said that to him, and his eyes lit up. He liked the title.
Yeah.
And 10 minutes later, the room was full of people in suits, all saying, we're very excited about this project. And there wasn't a project. There wasn't even a book. There was nothing. So then I had to come home and say, can I do a book called Awkward Situations of Men? Because I think I can make it into a thing. So we did that, which meant they could buy the rights, which meant they had a property, which meant there was a project.
Okay.
And then after that, every single meeting went as well as it could go. It was like a dream. It was like, it was almost like a joke. It was just odd. to the point where suddenly Warner Brothers were going, we want to make a sitcom out of it. And the head of Warner Brothers was going, I'm going to come with you to the meetings. Went to ABC. That meant we got the top person at ABC, who then went, let's go to the really top person at ABC. And suddenly there was a sitcom being made.
Called Awkward Situation.
Yeah. All based on one meeting where I just said a title.
your idea, yeah.
There was no... I remember even before the first meeting, they went... my agent rang up and went, of course, you've done a show Bible, yeah? And I went, what? And they said, you've done a show Bible. I went, I have not done that, no. The meeting's tomorrow morning. And they were like, oh, you better do one. I was like, well, how do I do it? And yeah. They said, well, you've got to do this and that. And I said, send me one. So they sent me one. And what I basically did was I copied the fonts and made something that looked a lot like a show Bible.
Yeah, yeah.
But did it in my own way. So here are the characters. This is the situation. Here's an example of something that might happen. And then just got into the room and started telling stories.
Yeah.
And that is what they were sort of into, the stories, because they wanted like a point of view.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, we made a pilot for a sitcom that I ended up being in.
I didn't know any of this.
Yeah, and I didn't expect to be in it.
For Warner Brothers?
Yeah, for ABC.
That's
and
amazing.
Warner Brothers. Yeah, and it was... I mean, the whole thing was ridiculous that it happened at all, but it was like... It was one of those things. It got down to the final three in the end. It didn't get through. And I was sad about it for a couple of days because it had been a lot of work. But then I was like, do you know what? I've done that. I've done a thing. And that's always sort of my philosophy is, you know, what were the chances of me being able to do that?
Yeah.
And we gave it a shot. And there was troubles and there was, like, you know, difficult and setbacks. But we did the best sort of we could under the circumstances. But at least I did it. And so that's always... maybe that's a self-protection thing as well.
Well, I was going to... I mean, it sounds a bit... like, for me to say this, it sounds a bit corny in a bit, but...
sometimes the best friends you make are the ones you make along the way.
from after the Yes Man... we call it a project. Now, I like doing
sure.
things projects.
I like projects, yeah.
After the Yes Man project, did you genuinely... your outlook change?
Yeah.
You were a lot more positive about things?
Yeah, I think so. And I would see opportunities... where perhaps I might have ignored or thrown them away.
Yeah.
Almost like watching a foreign film where someone's talking and the subtitles pop up. It was almost like that with sort of like yes moments.
Yeah.
Of going, well, I could do that, actually. I could go and see this absolutely awful sounding prog rock band 5 miles away and 3 bus changes.
Yeah.
Because it might end up being amazing. There might be a story at the end of it. You know, because you can always turn something bad into something good.
But you must
have that as well, like with stand-up. Like, something bad happens to you, or something awful, something annoying.
Yeah.
But that's good.
That's better than something good happening.
Yeah. No one wants to hear your story about a great holiday you had.
I know. It's sort of, the other people that I've spoken to on this about, who are writers, have all said that you just have to just do things. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
matter if they're good or bad or fun or not fun, just do things.
Yeah.
Because you just need as much like inspiration and experience as you can get.
Yeah, and I'm finding that difficult these days, like, because when we moved out of London, we moved to LA for a year, and there was lots of sort of material there, lots of things I could talk about. But because I was over there, I couldn't really talk about it to anyone, because a whole new group of people, all that kind of stuff. And now I've moved, and I've moved out of London, and I have to force myself to go out, do things, see things.
Yeah.
And it can be tiny things. It can be just, I'm not going to make a coffee at home. I'm going to walk into town, and I'm going to get a coffee, because something might happen.
Exactly, yeah.
Something tiny,
yeah.
But it'll give me an idea.
But I kind of used to think that the way to write stuff was to... I mean, obviously, this is, like, on a much different level to you, but the way to write stuff is to close yourself off in a room for 12 hours.
How do you write? Is that how you write?
Well, I sort of used to go, right, I'm going to make myself sit down for 6 hours today and write, and I'm not going to do anything else. But now, I sort of found that didn't really work.
Yeah.
And I would very rarely get anything worth... I would just sit there... beating myself up that I wasn't thinking of anything.
Yeah,
but
you're actually, creating a roadblock, yeah.
Yeah, but actually now I sort of just do things and just don't think about it and sort of make notes while you're doing stuff. And
that's what I do.
It's much easier.
Yeah.
Because you're actually like having experiences and you've got stuff.
Yeah, and you're in the moment. And if you're thinking about like what it's going to turn into, like with me, if it's, I don't know, a column or a story I'm going to tell on the radio or whatever, in that moment where it's happening, you start to, new ideas start to fire off about it, because you're looking at it kind of as a storyteller in a sort of weird way. You're thinking, how will I get this across? And then you talk to your friends in the pub and you say, this weird thing just happened to me. And you start to sort of hone the anecdote.
Yeah, yeah.
And find the new avenues.
Yeah. And also particularly for stand-up, I mean, because I think it sort of has to sound conversational anyway. Mm-hmm. So if you've sat and written it like a play, it will sound like that when you do it
on stage. Of course it will, yeah.
Much better to sort of...
But there's a place for that sometimes. There's a place for, like, flowery language or an unusual word.
Yeah.
But that, you know, to use to cut against all the conversational stuff, I guess.
Yeah. So has that been quite a recent realisation for you, or was that the last sort of since Yes Man?
Really, all the books, while I was writing them, because writing a book is a solitary thing.
I guess, have to be quite disciplined writing a book.
You do. I always feel like I've got Catholic guilt without being Catholic, about sort of like letting people down, or being late for a deadline, or being late, or not doing my work. I feel if I'm not doing something, if I'm not writing something, if I'm not coming up with an idea for something, I'm wasting time.
Yeah.
Ross Noble, I spent a lot of time with him, and we would travel around different countries. And if he had a 3-night run where he wasn't on stage, I mean, his leg would start to bounce. He would start to feel antsy because he needed to get it out. He needed to be working. He needed to have that. And I've always loved that about Ross. And it's something I sort of understand about him. He's got this need to get it out. And I've got a similar thing, but with ideas and working and all that. And I imagine you do as well.
Well, I kind of feel a bit, like you said, guilty about not working. Mm-hmm. Because I love doing this so much, and I feel so lucky to be doing it.
Yeah.
I sort of feel like the least I can do is work really hard at it, because it's so much fun to do it, and it does feel like it could all just go away.
But do you think it's probably changed in the last 10 years for the life of a stand-up? Because in the sort of the 90s and the 2000s, I think that the idea of the stand-ups were, and certainly from the people I know now and knew then, there was that idea of, oh, you play FIFA all day and then you go out and do a gig. Yeah. And that was sort of almost celebrated. And maybe that was sort of lad culture or whatever. And now, probably with the rise of things like Apollo, and since people started wearing suits again and treating it like a profession.
Yeah.
And probably the fact that material's just being eaten up at a much faster rate.
I think you're right. I think it's a lot more of a career now, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think people come into it with a lot more...
And you're young, so you must, you know...
I sort of came into it around that time as well. So when I sort of started comedy, it was a massive industry. And there was a lot of money in it. And, and it was like becoming a musician or becoming an actor. You knew that if you made it big, you would make a lot of money. So I guess that changes. I guess if you started in, like, the early 90s or noughties, when it wasn't a big industry, maybe people were a lot less... ambitious, because there wasn't, you didn't see anyone who was at that level.
Yeah.
Now you can see it, you can see how big it can become.
Yeah, and there's more respect probably from, in the old days it would have been like, oh, you know, lots of jokes about my parents would be disappointed in me being a comedian, but now it's like, it's a source of pride, because it means, it kind of goes hand in hand as well with it's being smart as well.
Yeah.
Because you're taking things that happen to you, or your thoughts about the world, and you are moulding them into something that people will immediately relate to.
Yeah.
And I don't mean in sort of an observational way, I just mean in a sort of emotional way or intellectual way.
Yeah.
So I think there's more respect now.
I don't know, I mean, am I right in saying that you were involved with the Mighty Boosh, like,
yeah,
right at the beginning of that?
Yeah.
So that would have been early noughties.
Yeah, that was, I first saw them in a pub, the Hen and Chickens, in Islington, in like the 90s. 12 people in the audience.
Yeah.
And I always remember a few years later being at like Brixton Academy or something with the same two lads.
Yeah.
But suddenly there were thousands of people dressed up as them.
Yeah.
And I'd never felt as bad as like leaving the sort of the little party afterwards and going out of a side exit at, I think, Brixton Academy, and everyone getting, just hearing screams and anticipation and gasps as the door opened, and just the sound of deflation as I walked out.
Yeah.
And I wasn't Noel or Julian. And just
they
thinking,
were
like
rock stars, weren't they?
Completely.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, when we were making the radio show, Noel would arrive, you know, he'd step off the bus, right?
Yeah.
On Kingsland Road in Shoreditch. But he already looked like a rock star.
Yeah.
And that wasn't, you know, Vince Noir. That was just Noel Fielding in tinsel, you know, a soldier's uniform made out of tinsel or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously Julian was a bit more serious. But Julian remains just one of the funniest people. Just the way he moves.
Yeah.
I can sit opposite him in a pub and I can just watch the way he moves. I can watch what his eyes do. They sort of dart around nervously.
Yeah.
Or I can watch what he does with his hands.
Yeah.
And it's all funny.
Yeah. So did you work...
But he once told me, though, his mum, Julian's mum, when he would go back to for Christmas or whatever, his mum, very proud of the bush or whatever, and she had like a little car, I don't know what, a Ford Fiesta or something. And she put like a Mighty Boosh sticker on the back that she got from a gig or something like, and then he would have to go out to like the Tesco Metro or something on Christmas Eve to get stuff, and people would recognise him, and he's stepping out of a tiny car
with the
Mighty Boosh sticker just on there, which would have been hell for Julian.
That's amazing. I once did this writing job on do you remember when Stars in Their Eyes came back and Harry Hill was presenting it?
Yeah.
I did a job on that when I honestly must have been about 17 or 18. But I remember he used to turn up. He had a light blue Rolls Royce.
Really?
Which had on the back of it a sticker that said, "No tools left in this vehicle." And
that
was so funny.
And you know he bought it for that gag.
Yeah, and he loved it. And I remember the first time I saw it and I was laughing about it, and I could see how much he obviously loved the fact that people saw that.
He spent £123,000 plus the cost of the sticker for that joke.
Amazing. Yeah. So did you work with the Bush all the way through?
When it came to... So we got this show away under the radar. Radio 4. I was a trainee comedy producer and I wanted to take the Bush to Radio 4. And, you know, had met them... you know, the Hen and Chickens, and then in Edinburgh, and our paths had kept crossing. Wanted to take it to Radio 4, and Radio 4 said, and I quote, "The Mighty Boosh is 1 million miles away from what we want on Radio 4. And I was obviously very disheartened by this, because I was like, "The Mighty Boosh is what you need on Radio 4, because your average listener is 72 years old, and in 8 years they're going to be 80, and then you might not have an average listener anymore. You've got to start bringing some people in." And my boss, John Pidgeon, was he was a dude. And he had been brought in to the BBC to great sort of controversy. Everyone was like, "Well, hang on, who is this guy?" And he had a varied career. He had a nice life, just living in the country, just doing what he wanted. He was rock and roll. He wrote the first ever review of The Police. He was a music journalist. He went on tour with, like, The Faces. And now suddenly he was in charge of, like, loads of bureaucracy and infighting at the BBC.
Yeah.
And he wanted no part of it.
Yeah.
He also liked to be a bit of a rebel and to buck the trend. And so when I was like, apparently it's a million miles away from Radio 4, he was like, "Let's see what we can do." And he found some scam that we could make it for local radio and somehow they would pay for it. And they would pay next to nothing for it. But it was just about fine. Most of the budget went on flying Rich Fulcher over from America, which had never been done. And he just like slept on Julian's couch.
Yeah.
And we tried to record it in a studio, and it didn't work because it was putting them under too much pressure. So we set up a makeshift studio in a disused disco in Shoreditch that smelt of fox urine. And there was, to get to the studio, as I called it, which was just a cave at the back that Noel decked out in velvet and stuffed animals.
Exactly how I hoped it would be made.
There was the soundproof booth was made out of velvet that he'd got from a second-hand shop and like stuffed animals from a taxidermist. And when that collapsed, we had to record it in a toilet. And in the room that you walked through to get to, in inverted commas, the studio, were like 14 fax machines being run by a man who was sending out spam faxes all over the world, just saying, hey, you know, we do this or that, and just bothering people. And I remember there was a model who would go around on roller skates with a dog called Red. And I always remember that people would talk to me and go, the great thing about the radio show is attention to detail. Because even in the background of some of the takes, because it's in a zoo, you'll sometimes hear a dog. And it's like a really, like, where it's not supposed to be. And I'm like, no, that was a dog. That was a dog that we weren't allowed to kill.
Yeah.
And we just made it. And then it went out on BBC London. Now, the Mighty Boosh, very much an acquired taste. The right time for it to go out is 11 o'clock at night on Radio 4, if it's going to go out there.
Yeah.
Maybe 6:30 when they get better known, but 11 o'clock's about right.
Yeah.
It went out at midday on BBC London on a Saturday.
Yeah.
Between, like, the sport.
Sure.
So you had, like, men in white vans and cabbies listening to what they wanted to listen to. Old school ska combined with football updates.
Yeah.
And then they'd have to go, let's just take a break for half an hour as we visit the knockabout whimsical world of the Mighty Boosh.
Yeah.
It was reviled. People were going, what the hell is this? But the plan worked, because then Radio 4 heard it and realised, hang on, Julian and Noel can write a narrative, and yeah, they can create characters, and they can write these songs, and their world that we don't understand actually makes sense. And so they went, we'll have the repeats. And so they put it out once and once only on Radio 4. They bought the repeats. And it meant that the Mighty Boosh suddenly found an audience. Steve Coogan heard it and went, I love it.
Yeah.
Made them an offer. They very kindly came to me and said, would you want to be involved? Would you want to produce? And I was like, if it's Baby Cow, I would go with Baby Cow. Because if it's me doing it, I've never done it.
Yeah.
And I don't think I could do it. Go with them, man. And they did. And I would bump into them in Soho. And they would excitedly take me into, like, the edit. And I'd be like, wow, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
But I couldn't have done it. I could do the radio, you know. And I did it, you know.
So you, at the time, you were a radio producer.
Yeah. But my job was to give them as much freedom as I could.
Yeah.
And to hide them from the BBC. And to keep them, you know, fine. And to make sure they had everything they needed. And then to be there, you know, and, you know, be as cool a producer as I could, you know.
Yeah. But did you have ambitions to go into TV?
Not really. I ended up doing it. I didn't like it as much, because my whole thing is I like to either make things on my own or with as small a team as possible, where we are left alone.
Yeah.
And we can do the thing we want to do.
Yeah.
And when I was producing, that was always what I tried to do with whoever I was doing it. Let's make it small scale. Let's make it you and me. I'll try and fob everyone off and hide a bit, but let's just do the thing that we want to do as much as possible. Because once you get into TV, you've got to rely on about 40 different people all to care as much as you do about the thing you're doing, and they don't, you know. They don't. And why would they?
I had like an experience with that. The first sort of I had this idea for a show that someone came up with after Edinburgh last year. There was about 10 people working on it, and it was all going really well. And then it was going to get made by Comedy Central, and then it didn't at the last minute. They just said they didn't want it. And I was like, really, not, you know, I thought it was going to happen. It was the first time it's ever happened to me, so I was, you know, like, annoyed about
it. Yeah, of course.
But I was sort of amazed by how little the other 10 people cared about it. They were just like, great, well, we'll do something else then.
I know.
And they instantly just moved on to something else. And I was like, oh, I thought we were...
I know. Team. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I always feel like in America, it's like that.
Brutal.
But much worse.
Yeah.
You'll spend ages talking with these people. You'll write this script. You'll solve all these problems. You'll have sold it. You'll have pitched it.
Yeah.
You'll have got everyone excited. Everyone's always excited about everything. And so you think, oh, wow, they're really excited about this.
Yeah.
And then I remember one project, I just got a phone call from this guy that I've been working with for ages, an exec, and he went, yeah, they're going to leave it there. They're not going to pick it up. And I was like, oh, man, all right. And I wanted to talk about it. And he's like, so yeah, I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah.
I was like, and then I was like, he'll phone back. Never phoned back.
That was it.
It was on to the next thing. And I get it. You know, you've got to out there. You've got to sort of do all that.
Is it noticeably worse in America?
Yeah.
Is it?
Oh, my God. There was a big pro. I was telling you before we were recording that when I moved to LA, just before I moved, like the stars aligning, I got this email, and it just had my name and the name of a film franchise that I happened to adore, and there was a question mark after it, as if to say, "Oh, does he want to be involved in this in some way?"
So obviously, Sex and the City.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Do I want to do an animated version for 9-year-olds? And so this thing came in, and I was like, wow, if this works out, this could be good. And so I worked. I pitched for it. I found myself on a Skype call with my favourite childhood director, and I made best case as I could, and suddenly I had the gig. And they said, when can you move out? I said, I'm moving out anyway. So suddenly I realised my plans might change because I'm there for a year anyway, but it might be longer. And before I know it, we've sold it to a major, well, to Netflix. And I've got to hire a second in command. I've got to hire a writing staff. I'm meeting all these people I'm going to be in charge of. There's hundreds of them underneath me. Now I'm thinking this could be a massive mistake. And as soon as I arrived there, this thing I could tell was starting to crumble. But no one was telling me.
Yeah.
And then I watched similar projects around it all crumble and all go away.
Yeah.
And then one day it was dead. And no one called me. No one called me for a day, 2 days, 3 days, a week. A week. No one's called me.
You're in charge of it.
And these people, no one's called to even commiserate.
Yeah.
There's not a fruit basket.
Some sort of card.
But now it's a challenge.
Yeah.
Because now it's become a game of chicken. Because it's like, I'm not phoning you. You should phone me.
Yeah.
You know, as far as you know, I mean, what you... I was astounded by the sort of the lack of compassion, empathy or care.
Yeah.
But then I started to understand it. I was like, there is no compassion because they don't care, because they're on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And I was a cog in the machine.
Yeah.
But because it was the biggest thing I was doing, I obviously thought I was a bigger part of it. But then you realise, no, you're not. You never are.
Yeah.
And everyone's got other stuff to do.
I don't, you know, I've had such little experience of it, but it seems like people are so scared of losing their job and they've got a career in this industry, and it's so hard to just have a career, so people are so worried about losing it that they'll just do anything, you know, to keep hold of their bit of power or their bit
And maybe they don't want to be the one to deliver bad news or to commiserate too much, because then they become the person you associate with it.
Yeah.
And that, in a sense, is a failure.
Yeah.
That, you know, on a perceived failure on their part. They think you're going to think that.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're just unfeeling bastards.
What, do you think that writing is the industry, is it? Sort of cutthroat, is that?
No, it's nice. I mean, you know, grown-up stuff, the books for grown-ups, there's a bit more there's more paranoia and snobbery, but there's probably also a bit more compassion. The kids' book world is lovely.
Yeah.
Like, I do a series of kids' books, and my God, everyone's having fun all the time.
Yeah.
Everyone's nice.
Yeah.
They're always eating cakes, you know what I mean?
Everyone's wearing dungaree.
Yeah.
Great.
So, and radio I find very nice. I mean, if I could only do two things, it would be writing and radio.
Yeah.
Probably for the reasons that we've said. The small teams, the fact you can do it on your own, the fact that you're in charge of what you say.
Yeah.
Those are the things. But what about you? Is it stand-up all the way, or what's the thing you want
to
do?
I don't know. I mean, I've only really done stand-up now, up to now. And I always want to do stand-up.
Do you have a plan?
No.
It's good not to have a plan sometimes.
I don't think it's a good idea.
No, you set yourself up for...
It's so unpredictable as well. How could you possibly have a plan?
Yeah, just do the thing. My whole thing has always been, go where the fun is.
Yeah.
But always, always try and do the fun well.
Yeah.
Work to make the fun good.
Yeah.
Because then you will inevitably be asked to have fun somewhere else.
Yeah.
So whether that's radio or TV or books or film or scripts or whatever, be adaptable, but let the idea excite you, and work basically.
I think someone might have said that. I think someone said to me something like, there aren't that many good things. like in this industry, so as long as you can make good things, mm-hmm. you'll always be fine.
Yeah.
Because there just aren't that many good things, genuinely yeah. good things.
I think so.
So I think there's probably a truth to that.
I think so. And doing it despite setbacks, you yeah. know, doing it despite people who often don't really know what they're talking about. Yeah. There's a lot of them about.
Yeah, but that's sort of another thing that I sort of realised through meeting people who work in TV, and you sort of realise that no one really knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
Even people with very important jobs.
Oh, totally.
You can sort of see in their eyes that they don't really know what they're doing.
Yeah, they don't know. You can very often see just moments of hesitation.
Yeah.
which are then papered over.
Yeah.
And rather than show you that weakness, they make a decision.
Yeah.
And whether it falls in your favour or not, it doesn't matter to them because they've just had to make a decision and they've done it.
Yeah.
And they're happy that they've got to that point.
Yeah.
You know, very often, I think it's different in America. I think that executives in America, while there are still many who you would suspect don't know what they're on about, there are so many more who do. Because they read scripts, they learn the sort of the nuances of it, they think about characters, they involve themselves in it much more. They can see what's on the page.
Yeah.
Whereas I think over here, unless, you know, unless on a page you've got the word fanny and you've made it slightly bigger font and maybe underlined it and maybe done some arrows, they might not spot the joke, but it has to, you know, that's why in Britain, I think there's been a tendency recently to have a lot more kind of rudeness in comedy, or not toilet humour, but sort of sexual humour and all that kind of stuff, which is great and has its place. But for a while, it was just a lot of cynicism and a glut of that. Mm. And it became quite a depressing thing to watch because it was just that. There was no sort of joy. There was no kind of... nothing that really reflected how we speak to each other
yeah.
on an everyday basis.
Yeah.
It was all just, yeah, the word fanny in a bigger font.
But then you get things that are, you know, how we speak to each other, and they're massive, you know, like Peep Show.
Yeah, and they sneak through.
The Office, and they become huge.
And you know what? Everybody claims credit for it. Yeah. I've met 5 or 6 different people
yeah.
who all signed off on, developed and commissioned Catastrophe.
Yeah.
And they can't all have done that. There's no yeah. way.
Yeah.
But very often in British sort of broadcasting, I've sort of found that if you produce a gardening programme
yeah.
on BBC One, you might get asked to take care of mornings on BBC One. And if you can keep your nose clean and keep Homes Under the Hammer on the air, you probably get asked to take care of daytime. And then if you can do a couple of years of daytime,
yeah.
you might well get sort of prime time. And before you know it, you are head of commissioning
yeah.
of comedy or entertainment yeah. or anything because you've stayed somewhere. Mm. And that's not the same as going out to see comedy
no.
or understanding what a joke is
no.
or doing anything. You see them when they're taken out by their teams or whatever to like a night of stand-up.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can tell because they laugh at everything because they've never been to one before. So everything is funny.
I've seen that, yeah.
yeah. Everything is hilarious.
I remember on that thing, that Stars in Their Eyes thing, what I remember watching, because one of my jobs was sort of assisting Harry Hill, and I remember watching him argue with a producer about this joke that he thought was funny and she didn't. Yeah. And I remember thinking, I mean,
who are you going to trust?
He's one of the Perrier ones.
Yeah.
He's a sort of hugely famous comedian.
Yeah.
Why would you not listen to him yeah. about what's funny?
Yeah. Let him try it. And if it turns out you're not right, you know, it turns yeah. out that it doesn't work with the audience, well, just edit it out. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But let Harry Hill
yeah, try it.
Be Harry Hill. It is extraordinary. I remember doing hosting a quiz show at the BBC, and it was like a shiny floor BBC One quiz. Yeah. And before you record it, you do a little run through, and it's really just a technical run through. It's really just the cameras know what's going on. We yeah. can test the slides, but we need some contestants. So, you know, we know that tonight we're getting a bobslayer, someone from EastEnders,
yeah.
and a weatherman.
Yeah.
But they're not going to turn up for that. Of course not. You don't want them there. So you get students in or whatever just to stand there. And their job, you know, I'll go, oh, so, you know, Percy Thrower. I'm trying to find a, I don't know, Percy Thrower, what were you like, what were you like in the old days? And then, but then the student has to do a bit of sort of bantering. But the thing is, they're not the person. They're not earning the money.
Yeah.
They're not used to it. So they'll just say something. Someone will try and be too funny, which just kills it. Someone will be cocky because their mate is watching, and that kills it.
Yeah.
And someone will just not give you anything, which just kills it.
Yeah.
So obviously, for an outside pair of eyes, this looks like it's going to be an awful show. But the audience isn't in. There's not the electricity in the air. You're not doing it. I'm not doing it properly.
Yeah.
And you've got students there not doing it properly either. And I remember being taken to one side by an exec and just going, are you happy? I was going, yeah. I think it's going to be all right. She's going, but it just seemed a bit low energy. And I was going, what do you mean? And she went, just the whole thing just seemed quite, like, will the guests be funnier? And I was like, the guests?
Well, we'll have guests.
Yeah. I was like, they weren't the guests.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, right. I was going, no, they were just some students that we got in. You know, that no, the guests, no, it's going to be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I find myself reassuring the person who's sort of in charge of the show that Adam Woodyatt from EastEnders is going to be fine. And also, I don't know if you've seen EastEnders, but, you know, that was a small black man.
Yeah.
That wasn't him.
That's the weird thing about panel shows now is you get sort of comics at my sort of level and you get people from Love Island.
Yeah, and Bonnie Langford.
Yeah, and people from, like, the history.
Yeah.
It's mad. I also noticed about those American shows, and I guess it's a money thing, but when you look at some massive American comedy show, then it'll have, like, 15 writers.
Yeah.
As opposed to here, when it'll be, like, two or three.
Yeah, and also those writers will be very good and pretty well remunerated.
Yeah.
And they will be desperate to make it really good because they want to make their name, because they want to get to the next thing.
Yeah.
So you tend to get, like, a really sort of a good quality of writer there. But also that's just because it's a numbers game. There's 270 million Americans.
Yeah.
And there's not that many of us.
No.
And there's fewer still sort of trying to break into showbiz because, you know... It's different here. But yeah, no, they will have, yeah, they'll have many more writers. And there's much more of a career strategy and a career plan. And if you can get 8 weeks on a sitcom out there, then, you know, it will really help you career-wise and also just financially. Whereas over here, you know, they're still vastly underpaying people and understaffing. You know, they wonder why we can't do a daily show. Pay for it.
Yeah.
Got the people. That's been shown to you by the fact that John Oliver, a man who is great but was largely ignored.
Yeah.
You know, I guess again because I don't know. Maybe he wears. I don't know why he would have been ignored.
Do you think that because they are trying to make stuff? You know, they are trying. There are American shows. I mean, they're trying to make Saturday Night Live.
Over here.
How many times?
Yeah, there was, yeah, so there was like Saturday Live in the 90s with like Lee Hurst and people like that. And they try it and, you know, there's always a lot of excuses. But I think you could, I do think you could do it.
Yeah.
We've got the talent. Maybe we couldn't do it every night.
I kind of feel like it gets hyped up too much.
Mm.
Do you remember a couple of months ago they did the nightly show?
I do, and I thought that was such a wasted opportunity.
Because that could... But it was just hyped up too, and it was on every trailer, and there was posters everywhere, and the British public instantly go, we don't like it.
Yeah, and also... Yeah, exactly. Exactly that. But also, it was a stupid show, right? And what people want right now is smart shows with a point of view and an opinion. And that's what they should have done. They should have stuck to one host and made it smart and not done stupid games... Not get, you know, Kim Cattrall on and ask her for the millionth time what it's like to have lived in Liverpool a million years ago. Have a point of view.
Yeah.
And don't just talk about British things either. Talk about the world, like from our perspective. And do it well and write it down and don't be afraid of doing a 5-minute monologue, you know, well written, perceptive, funny, angry.
Yeah.
It was just too silly, too stupid.
I think maybe they
too
were
inconsequential.
At, you know, Fallon and Corden, who all make sort of quite silly shows, really.
Yeah.
I think maybe that was the idea.
Well, then stick to one host, and
yeah.
then when you lose your nerve after 5 weeks,
yeah.
keep going, because
yeah.
they've got to bed in.
Yeah.
It's like anything. It's like breakfast shows. It's like you have to become part of a routine. It takes a while for people to get used to you.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they would have just lost their nerve. I mean, part of that is we've got to have a different host every week.
Yeah.
Okay, David Williams is very big, but follow up with a chef.
How is that sustainable, though, a new host every week?
Yeah.
What if it was commissioned for a year?
Yeah.
A new host every week.
And the features kept changing, and it was like, it was just a different show every time,
yeah.
and none of it was bedding in. So,
yeah. That's a British, because I sort of feel like anything that's overhyped here tends to flop in terms of TV.
Yeah, well, I also think that if you're going to... Yeah, absolutely, the overhyping gives people a reason to hate you already.
Yeah.
But also paying attention to Twitter, paying attention to social media.
Yeah.
Have the balls to not do that.
Yeah.
I've done shows, you know, years ago where I remembered the first thing an exec said to me was, oh, it went down well on Digital Spy. And I remember just thinking, I don't care. Was it good?
Yeah.
You know, we're putting too much faith in the opinions of drunk people who happen to be watching something at 11 at night.
Yeah.
And the papers end up reporting on, now there's a news story if 11 people don't like a program.
Yeah.
Who cares? Make a good program.
Yeah. The sort of people who go on Twitter and say, I'm watching whatever and it's shit, I don't know anyone who would do that.
No.
None of my friends would tweet about something. So who are these people?
I don't know.
Doing it?
Unless you can make a good joke about
they
it.
They must be, like, you know...
permanently angry.
Yeah.
They don't do it with, but they don't do it with crisps. They don't do it with, you know, chips. Yeah, they save that for other people. You know, it's a sort of a willingness to try and inflict something. I'll inflict my opinion on the world.
Yeah.
But I also think if you're going to make a show that you want to be as American as possible, employ some Americans.
Yeah.
Employ some experts.
Yeah.
Use British talent. But just let them get it off the ground.
Yeah.
What is it that they do? How do they work? How should the room work?
Yeah.
Everyone talks about the writer's room, and then they try and start one in Britain, but it's with people who have never been in an American room before.
Yeah.
I spent a couple of days at The Onion watching what they did, and it was brilliant. It was like a TV writer's room, and some of the best writers of comedy that I've ever sort of sat around would each bring in like 10 brilliant knockout jokes. And they were just jokes. They were just funny headlines. There was no story to it. It was just, does it make you laugh or not? And 200 jokes, I think, went on this whiteboard. And over the 2 days, they whittled it down to something insane, like 4. Any of those jokes, they're not allowed to bring those jokes back. You can't repitch. So all those jokes are dead. And they were some of the best jokes that I had seen. You know, they're just funny ideas.
Yeah.
And I had so much respect for what they were willing to throw away. But it does feel like sort of writers' rooms over here. And there are some that aren't that way. I've got friends who do things that way and they do a brilliant job. It just feels like too many of them just go, that's all right, yeah, we'll do that then. And there's 3 ideas on the board.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, quality control.
Do you have, just to finish, do you have things that you haven't achieved that you still would really like to...
Yeah, loads. I mean, you know, for every thing you do that flies or that does well, there's like 10 things that haven't.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's always things that you want to go back to. You know, I'd like to try my hand at a full sitcom run, not just, you know, a pilot or a script, but being able to flesh things out, create a world. I've got a film I'd like to write, a couple of them. So I mean, there's always stuff to do, but there's always other stuff that gets in the way as well that you have to get out of the way.
Yeah.
Just to pay your bills and just to, because you've said you will.
Yeah.
I'd like nothing more than to have just a clear month where I go, that's what I'm doing this month. That and nothing else.
Yeah.
Nothing else. I would love that. So we'll see.
Surely with, like, you know, the book's coming out, you can go, right, well, we can now block off a few months now that I've done this book.
You pay more attention to it, certainly,
yeah.
But you still have other things you need to do, or just to scratch an itch as well. That's why I do a radio show every week. You know, I do that, and it's only a couple of hours, but I do that to scratch an itch and flex a muscle.
Yeah.
Just telling stories or coming up with ideas in the moment. That's what I love about radio. You'll get a text 1 minute before you go on air,
yeah,
and you just decide to throw everything you've done away,
yeah,
and go with that.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you're asking someone to get a certain bit of music, and you're writing a sketch, and you're saying to one guy, you do this, or, you know, whatever, and then you create a little moment, you get, yeah, a caller on, and it's exciting.
Yeah.
And you just do it for a couple of hours, and then I feel better for the whole week.
Yeah.
You know, and then I just do my other stuff. So, yeah, so I find it all exciting. What about you? What's the thing that you want to do?
Well, I don't... It's stand-up at the moment. That's,
yeah,
what it is, at least for the next, you know, few years. I'd like to get really good at stand-up and then do other stuff.
Mm.
But I feel like it would be bad to try and do too many things at once.
Mm.
I just like to get really good at one thing.
Hone your craft.
And then hopefully do other stuff.
Yeah.
But the other stuff won't happen unless I'm really good at stand-up.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Of course it does. Yeah, you know, you've got your passion and you want to kind of,
yeah,
do it and you know and write it and hone it and, you know, get new ideas. I found it very disappointing recently when I realised that so many stand-ups, when they get super busy, you know, do end up employing loads of writers and stuff.
Yeah.
And people who aren't stand-ups but do stand-up, but have shows written for them by other people, I always think that's cheating.
Yeah.
I think that what you say has to come from you.
Yeah.
And just as a fan of stand-up and as an audience member and all the rest of it and sort of the experience I've had around it for so many years, for me, the purity of it is what really matters. I want to know that you had that thought.
Yeah.
And when you tell a story, even if it's sort of made up or embellished, I want to know that it came from you.
Yeah.
Even if it's not true, I don't care.
Yeah.
You're the mind telling it to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose, because I think the argument, because I know, I think people would be surprised at how many, like, really well-known stand-ups do that.
Yeah.
But I think the argument they would say is that they're just too busy, or they don't have enough time to write that amount of...
Then I'd say don't
material.
Do it.
But yeah.
I say don't do it. What are you busy with? Do that,
yeah,
then.
Yeah.
So why are you doing this?
Yeah.
Don't do that until you can do it.
Yeah, it's not a money thing.
No, because you're shortchanging people.
Yeah.
It's, you're acting.
Yeah.
That's what I don't like. I think if you're too busy, just do the other thing.
Yeah, it's quite weird. With stand up, you sort of, you know, Edinburgh Festival, you'll go and have a good show, and then TV people will come, and they'll ask you if you have any ideas for scripted sitcoms.
Yeah.
That seems to be the only thing they really want is,
yeah,
sort of scripted.
Yeah.
And it always strikes me as quite weird, because it's like you know, you've just watched me do an hour of,
yeah,
stand-up,
yeah,
which was good. You've said you liked it, and now you're saying, can you do something completely different?
Yeah,
you've just done?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you know,
loved your stand-up. Have you got any ballets you want to write?
Yeah, have you thought about starting an estate agent? It always strikes me as quite odd.
Yeah, it is.
And I sort of, you know, you don't want to let them down, so you want to say something.
Yeah.
Go, oh yeah, I've got loads of ideas.
Yeah.
But actually, the reason that the show was good is because you've just been doing that for the last,
yeah,
4 years, whatever.
Exactly.
It's always strikes me as a bit odd.
So you got any good ideas for scripted?
It is something I would like to do in the future, but, you know, I'm not really in any rush.
No. Don't rush it.
Ladies and gentlemen, there we go, Danny Wallace. Amazing. That was really cool. I really enjoyed chatting to Danny. So a big thank you, Danny, if you're listening. Thank you for having me. And big thank you always to Joel Grove, who produces the show, and Will Shahada for the editing, and my manager, Rick Hughes, for all your help. And thank you to you for listening. And yeah, it's great. We've got some amazing guests in the next few weeks, which I'd like to announce, but I can't. But they're good. So keep listening and subscribe to the show if you've not already. Give it 5 stars on iTunes. Tell your friends about it. And yeah, we will see you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.